any definition of goodness that society liked to frame. Instead, he applied a code learned from bitter experience where good meant fighting the odds, clawing upward, spitting in the eye of your enemies, and not asking for help or pity. He'd never been a whiner and never would be. His mantra was simple. Do what was necessary, then force a smile onto your face and take another crack at whatever. Buddha said it best. There is no wealth like knowledge, and no poverty like ignorance. But Einstein added a great caveat. Information is not knowledge. Absolutely true, since the most successful person was the one with the best knowledge. And an investment in knowledge always paid high interest. He liked to tell prospective clients that the price of light was far less than the cost of darkness. Information was like money. To be valuable, it had to circulate, which increased not only its quantity, but also its worth. Holding information only eroded its value. But thank goodness ready, willing, and able buyers existed for nearly everything. He finished his dinner and rang the silver bell that sat next to his wine goblet. One of the uniformed staff appeared, and he asked that the plate be removed and a fresh one brought with a second helping of pork. While he waited, he sat in the high-backed gilded chair and considered the next 2 days. Nearly everything was ready, but the unexpected was what worried him, like the man tied up in the basement, and Reinhard. He heard footsteps and assumed the server had returned with his food, which was damn quick. Instead, Vic entered the dining hall and walked over to the table. Do you want some dinner? He asked Vic. No, thank you. I'll eat later. The server returned with his plate. Oh, sit down. Eat. Bring my friend here some pork, he said, glad to have the company, along with wine. He and Vic had shared many meals together, so he knew his acolyte would not argue. So much is at stake on this deal, Vic. More so than on any we've ever had. It is also exciting, wouldn't you say? He made a point to always use the plural we, never the singular I. It connoted a team, which made everyone feel included. He amplified that feeling by always sharing generously with the help. That was why so many loved to work for him and were so loyal. He was especially generous to Vic, whom he counted on in many ways. One of those was as a handy forum upon which to test new ideas. I made a mistake thinking we could keep this venture quiet, Jaunty said, his voice low, but I truly thought we had everything under control. If Reinhard knew we were in Bratislava, he knows we're here. I agree, which is disturbing. So what is he waiting for? Probably for his men to report in. Good point. So he'll soon be wondering what happened to him. Vic nodded. And there will be others coming. The server returned. He motioned for Vic to eat, but Jaunty's appetite had waned. Assurance was what he needed, and that could not be brought to him on a plate. There are 2 relics of the Arma Christi left, he said, and less than 24 hours to RSVP. One of those involves the Americans. What if they refuse to participate? I took a chance making personal contact and extending them a special invitation. Maybe that was foolish. He wondered if Washington was responsible for Reinhardt's presence. But how could that be? A leak? That was possible. An old Persian proverb came to mind, one he'd come across in his readings. The man who knows not, but knows not that he knows not, is a fool. Shun him. A wise precaution. The man who knows not, and knows that he knows not, is a student. Teach him. Definitely. The man who knows, but knows not that he knows, is asleep. Awaken him. That was where he currently found himself. But the man who knows, and knows that he knows, is a teacher. Learn from him. Absolutely. When do you leave to head north? He asked Vic. Shortly. Originally, Vic would have handled things tonight alone. But Jaunty decided on a change in plan. "I want to go with you," he said. Chapter 9. The accumulation of holy relics started with Helena, the mother of Constantine the Great. She was granted the high title of Augusta Imperatrix and allowed unfettered access to the imperial treasury so she could secure the precious objects of the new Christian tradition. To fulfill her mission, in AD 326, at the age of 80, she traveled to Palestine as the first Christian archaeologist. In Jerusalem, she ordered a temple that had been built over the site of Christ's tomb near Calvary torn down and a new church erected. According to legend, during the construction, remnants of three different crosses were discovered. Was one the cross upon which Christ died? Nobody knew. To find out, the empress commanded that a woman who was near death be brought to the site. When the woman touched the first and second crosses, her condition did not change. But when she touched the third, she immediately recovered. Helena declared that to be the true cross and ordered the building of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at that spot. And so began the veneration of objects. From its inception, Christian belief depended on the miraculous, with Christ rising from the dead. Relics became a part of that belief, filling a void after pagan idols were banned. They were common prior to AD 1000, but the Crusades brought a new wave of relics into Europe. Thousands of objects, everything from teeth to appendages, bones, blood, even entire bodies. For a church to possess a relic meant that pilgrims would come, and with them, a constant revenue stream. Not surprising, then, that so many faux relics appeared, as it was much easier to create your own than travel to find one. The Protestant Reformation brought change, as relics horrified the reformers. John Calvin said that if all the fragments of the true cross were gathered together, they'd fill a large ship. Yet the Gospels testified that a single man was able to carry it. After 1517, Martin Luther, relics lost much of their importance, but eventually seven attained special status. The true cross, the crown of thorns, the pillar of the flogging, the holy sponge, the holy lance, the nails, and the holy blood. The arma Christi, weapons of Christ, instruments of passion. According to Corinthians, to those who renounced the weapons of this world, the arma Christi were a great protection against temptation. Cotton listened as Stephanie explained. The arma Christi still exist, though there is debate as to which are the true relics and which are fakes. But the Vatican solved that problem by compiling its own official list. Pieces of the true cross were everywhere. The largest and most notable sat in the monastery of Santo Toribio de Liebana in Cantabria, Spain. The crown of thorns seemed equally scattered, many claiming that their thorn was authentic. But the one in St. Anthony's Chapel in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, had acquired a stamp of authenticity. A segment of the Pillar of the Flogging, supposedly retrieved by Helena herself, remained in Rome's Basilica of St. Prisede. The Holy Sponge moved from Palestine to Constantinople to France, ending up in Notre Dame. Whether Christ was crucified with three or four nails had been long debated, but legend said that Helena, while in Palestine, found four nails. She supposedly cast one into the sea to calm a storm. A second was mounted into Constantine's battle helmet. A third was fitted to the head of a statue, and a fourth was melted down and molded into a bit for Constantine's horse. Yet there were dozens of nails scattered across Europe. The Vatican ended the debate by blessing the one on display at the cathedral in Bamberg, Germany, as authentic. The sixth relic, the Holy Blood, was here in Bruges, Stephanie said, or at least it has been for the past nine centuries. The seventh is the Holy Lance. People are stealing these relics, he asked. She nodded. Over the course of the last 3 months, five have been taken. Two remain, the nail and the Holy Lance. What had Ian Fleming written? Once is happenstance, twice is coincidence. Three times is enemy action. We need to go, she said, and they left the market square, walking back toward where the Basilica of the Holy Blood stood. From there, Stephanie led him down an enclosed path identified as Blinde Eselstraat, Blind Ass Street, which emptied into a small plaza that accommodated a columned concrete arcade. The fish market. He knew the story. For centuries, fresh saltwater fish had been sold in Bruges' main square. Centuries ago, the delicacy was expensive, available only to the rich. The common folk complained about the stench, so in the early part of the 19th century, the merchants moved here, away from the crowd. It remained in use to this day, but no one was hawking their catch this evening. A placard informed them that the market was only open a few days a week, from 8 until noon. A crowd had collected beneath the colonnade, taking advantage of the empty concrete tables. Children played on the cobblestones beyond. Are we going somewhere in particular? He asked Stephanie as they walked. She stopped near the pavilion. We have a serious situation developing in Poland. He heard the concern in her voice. The Fox administration wants to bring back the European interceptor site. He shook his head in disbelief. In 2007, the United States opened talks for a missile defense system to be located in Poland. It would consist of 10 silo-based interceptors to be used in conjunction with a tracking and radar system to be located in the Czech Republic. The idea was to protect against missiles from Iran, but Russia strongly objected, interpreting the move as a test of American strength. In retaliation, the Russian president threatened to deploy short-range offensive missiles in Kaliningrad to counter any supposed defense system. Europe likewise expressed deep reservations. France, Germany, and Italy all opposed the move, thinking it more provocative than strategic. The uproar continued until the Obama administration finally canceled the proposal. They really want to step into that ant pile again? He asked. They definitely want to go there. The thinking is to send a message to Moscow that there's a new sheriff in town. Things are going to be different. A way to show the world that Fox is a man to be reckoned with. Talk about poking the bear. As I recall, the uproar against the missiles was nearly uniform. Nobody thought it was a good idea. Fox hates the European Union and NATO. He spent the last few months antagonizing nearly every ally we have. He doesn't give a damn what the EU or Russia wants. They stood on the backside of the high-pitched roof of the old town hall, its pinnacles, turrets, and spires giving play to fanciful light and shade. The path ahead, past the fish market, was lined with bars and cafes preparing for another night's business. Tables dotted the cobbles, many already filled with folks enjoying supper. The time was approaching 8 p.m., and he was a little hungry himself. The key to everything this time, Stephanie said, is the president of Poland. He alone will make or break any decision about the deployment of those American missiles. He wants them. That all depends, she said. An odd answer. So he tried, what do missiles in Poland have to do with the Arma Christi? Quite a bit. Those thefts happened for a reason. A rather strange reason, but definitely a reason. He could tell that there was more to the story. When are you going to tell me? Right now. Follow me. Chapter 10 Cotton walked with Stephanie past more cafes with tables and wicker chairs under colorful awnings. She avoided all of them and headed for one of the ivy-clad buildings that fronted a canal. An iron sign attached to the brick facade read, Le Quincaillerie, hardware store. An odd name for a restaurant. Inside was strictly old world with smoke-blackened beams, marble-topped tables, and waiters in starched black aprons. The rough brick walls were adorned with prints and mementos collected over the generations. The windows were open to the evening, facing the same canal he'd sped down earlier. Across the water were more brick buildings with terraces and diners. A man waited at one of the windowside tables, medium height with a thin, quiet, clean-shaven face, sallow skin, and modest brown hair. He wore a dark suit and tie and stood as they approached. Cotton, Stephanie said. This is Tom Bunch. He works with the White House. Handshakes were exchanged, and they sat. Tom is the deputy assistant to the president and the deputy national security advisor, Stephanie said. Cotton caught the emphasis on the word deputy, repeated twice, surely on purpose, knowing how she felt about that label. The Magellan Billet's bureaucracy was simple. She had total control. No deputies. No seconds in command. All decisions from one source. Tom is the reason I'm here in Belgium, she said. The Justice Department was asked to assist the White House with this matter, and the Attorney General delegated it to the Magellan Billet, with specific orders to work with Tom. That meant the president had wanted the task given to the Billet. The more important question, which Stephanie surely had asked herself, was why, considering how Fox felt about her and the Billet. A waiter appeared with menus and asked for drink orders. Bunch requested a rather expensive French red wine. Stephanie opted for sparkling water. Cotton chose the still version. Carbon dioxide immersed in liquids had never been his thing. Alcohol was also something he'd never acquired a taste for, along with coffee, cigarettes, or almost anything that came from a pharmacy. Bunch scanned the menu, so he decided, what the heck, why not? He was hungry, and the offerings appeared robust and filling. No gourmet fare, thank goodness. The Half's blanket, veal in a creamy sauce, caught his eye. He also saw there was a dame blanche for dessert. The waiter returned with their drinks, and Bunch asked that they have a few minutes before ordering. You look a little wrinkled, Bunch said. Stephanie said you took a swim in the canal. It's part of the tour excursion I booked. A chance to experience the canals firsthand, he said, trying to make light of things. But Bunch did not seem amused. I don't know anything about you, but Stephanie says you're the man for this job. I assume you know about Jeanty Olivier. The question came with an aura of self-importance, as if everyone knew the name. Why don't you enlighten me? Cotton asked, and he caught the grin on Stephanie's lips at his self-restraint. I'm a little surprised you've never heard of Olivier. He caught the smugness. This guy wasted little time getting on people's nerves. Jeanty Olivier, Stephanie said, is a broker. We talking books, art, real estate? Bunch chuckled. You really are out of the loop. How long have you been retired? How long have you been a deputy national security advisor? Since January? 6 whole months. What did you do before? That's not relevant. I'm now with the White House, and I'm in charge here. That's what matters. He slid his phone from a pocket, waterproof, so it had survived the swim, and opened to a search engine. He typed Tom Bunch, White House, and found many references. He decided on the Wikipedia link. Why not? Might as well see what the masses thought of him. He touched the screen and called up the page, which was, not surprisingly, short. Bunch, throughout the presidential campaign, wrote a number of pro-Fox articles under a pseudonym, E. Pluribus Unum. He was critical of the left and right, but never the pro-Fox conservatives. He portrayed the election as a battle to save America, and in one article, described it as the Flight 93 election, referencing the plane that was hijacked on September 11, 2001, but which crashed after passengers fought back against the hijackers. Charge the cockpit or you die, he wrote. Then he went on to say, you may die anyway. You, or the leader of your party, may make it into the cockpit and not know how to fly or land the plane. There are no guarantees, except one. If you don't try, death is certain. The true meaning of that statement remains unknown. Before coming to the White House, Bunch worked for Birdie Macro LLC, which manages the personal capital of Rich Birdie, a huge financial supporter of Warner Fox during the election. What are you doing? Bunch asked. Reading about you. Bunch glanced at Stephanie. This is a waste of time. He's unacceptable. I was thinking the same about you, Cotton said, and now I know why. His eidetic memory kicked in, and he recalled press accounts about President Fox's attitude toward the National Security Council. Too big, too diverse, unwieldy, in need of trimming. Fox favored fewer meetings, less input, less paperwork. The pundits had translated that into him wanting total command of foreign policy, with little to no input from others. Several senators had publicly proclaimed the White House incompetent, insular, and indecisive. Decision-making was slow to non-existent and usually wrong. The goal seemed to be to please the boss, not enunciate and implement clear national security goals. The best explanation for why all of that was happening? Unqualified people, in positions of authority, kissing ass. A perfect example of which was sitting across the table. "Do you have any idea what you're doing?" he asked Bunch. "I have the ear of the President of the United States. I'm here at his personal direction. That's all you need to know." He should leave. Forget the $150,000. Head back to his hotel, take a shower, go to bed, and attend the book fair tomorrow as planned. This was not his problem. He'd already done way too much. The older he got, the more he found that he suffered no fools, was impatient with mediocrity and disdainful of subtlety. But three things kept his butt in the chair. First, the look of frustration in Stephanie's eyes. Second, he was hungry, and the veal and cream sauce sounded wonderful, not to mention a white lady for dessert. And third, that was the kicker. But first, "Tell me about Jaunty Olivier," he asked Stephanie, returning to the issue at hand and ignoring Bunch. "He's British, but holds a dual passport with Switzerland, thanks to his Swiss mother. He was fairly non-existent until about 15 years ago, when he emerged as a broker who accumulates and trades information. I'm told the CIA and NSA have regularly used him. He's proven both reliable and reasonable. He has no political affiliations, no personal causes, no morals, no scruples. He's just a businessman, buying and selling, trading, making money. He deals with people, corporations, governments. Doesn't matter to him. Reports say he's a man of patrician tastes and earthy language." He smiled. "Where is he based?" "He moves around constantly," Bunch said. "He prefers renting luxury condos and staying in five-star hotels to owning mansions. He generally keeps a low profile and works through the internet, wire transfers, and intermediaries." Cotton noticed that Bunch spewed out facts about a bad guy the way someone who'd never served in the military told war stories. "He also avoids breaking laws," Bunch said. "He skirts close, but always stays just on the legal side. Olivier recently made contact with the White House. He and the president knew each other from before the election." "Interesting. They're friends." "They've done business in the past. Olivier talked directly with the president about this matter." "Was that wise?" Stephanie asked, clearly surprised. "This whole situation is just grandiose extortion."
"What situation?"
"The president knows how to make a deal," Bunch said, clearly annoyed. "It was his forte in business. He prefers personal contact and personal assessment."
"You really don't have any idea what you're doing," Cotton declared. "I resent your insubordination," Bunch said. He shrugged. "Last I looked, I don't work for you. And I doubt you will." Time for that third thing. The kicker. They sat adjacent to an open window. A bronze wind chime just outside sounded a mournful pentatonic. Occasionally, one of the tour boats cruised by beneath on the canal, the city's fleet one short tonight. White swans dotted the calm brown water, long-necked, heavy-bodied, big-footed birds whose gracefulness belied their cantankerous personality. Across the canal, he caught sight of a familiar face, one he'd noticed a few moments before. Another swan of sorts, slim and lean, cool and sleek, sure of herself, ash-blonde hair falling in casual disarray to thin shoulders. Her full mouth was a little wide for her nose, a small imperfection that, to him, only added to her allure. He knew her to be almost wolf-like, with the blue eyes to match. In many ways, she was a fortress, often scaled and assaulted, but never conquered. Sonia Draga. Sitting alone at a terrace table, her gaze locked across the canal, straight at him. "Hold that thought," he said to Bunch, and he rose from the table. Chapter 11. Cotton left the restaurant and turned right out the front door, following the cobblestones over another of the footbridges that ended at the ring road. Cars chugged by in both directions.
From there, the sidewalk led to another footbridge, back toward Old Town and the buildings that sat on the opposite side of the canal from La Quincaillerie. He found an eatery, this one with a more benign name of Le Quai, the Quay, a busy tavern that, considering the aromas, specialized in fish. It filled another of the guild houses, diners inside and out. He bypassed the maitre d's stand and headed for the terrace. The table he'd spotted from across the canal was empty, its occupant gone. He was about to leave when he noticed a piece of paper tucked beneath a saucer with his name printed on top. He stepped over and slipped it free. "So lovely to see you again, Cotton." He smiled at the feminine script and glanced across the water at the open window in Le Quincaillerie. Stephanie was staring his way. Only Tom Bunch's hands were visible, moving, apparently talking to her, oblivious to anything happening that did not include him. He sympathized with her predicament, forced to deal with imbeciles. Danny Daniels had understood how to get the job done, which was why he'd been the perfect partner in the White House. Daniels and the Magellan Billet had done a lot of great things together. Of course, Daniels was not a guy who craved credit. Results. That's all he'd ever wanted. He left the terrace, retraced his route to Stephanie and Bunch, and sat again at the table. "Where were we? I think you said that Jaunty Olivier contacted the White House." Bunch tossed him a quizzical look. "Where'd you go?" "Bathroom." Which seemed to satisfy the moron. Stephanie, though, definitely wanted to know more, but his gaze signaled later. "That's right," Bunch said. "Olivier first made contact with us 2 months ago. He sent a personal message." Bunch found his phone, tapped, and handed it over. On the screen was a photo of an invitation with black and gold Edwardian script. "Your presence is requested for a sale of information concerning President Janusz Tchaikovsky of the Republic of Poland. If interested, send a reply to this address. Missiles or not at de.com. "Seems the sender has something to sell," Cotton said. He faced Stephanie. "Which concerns the European interceptor site." She nodded. This came about a month after the White House announced the renewed missile objective. By then, half of Europe, China, and Russia had all come out against it. Olivier seems to have seen an opportunity and set up an auction for some damaging information that could affect the decision. As I said earlier, this all seems like just grandiose blackmail against the President of Poland. When the White House replied to the email address, Bunch said, Olivier answered personally. "Or at least someone using his name answered," Stephanie added. He caught her tone. The reply had been handled without the appropriate safeguards in place. "It was Olivier," Bunch said. "He and the president spoke by phone. We want that information." "What kind of information?" Cotton asked. "The embarrassing, political career-killing kind," Bunch said. "James Tchaikovsky is about to stand for re-election. We need him to win that election, then do exactly what we want, or to be forced to resign now, since the man who would assume the role of acting president is quite friendly to us. He would be much easier to deal with." Somebody had been reading their intelligence briefs. Kudos to Bunch. But Cotton noticed how the guy pronounced the Polish president's name. Not Tchaikovsky, like the composer, more Tchaikovsky. And he used the English James instead of Janusz. It seemed that a deputy assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor would at least know how to properly pronounce a foreign dignitary's name. "What is it exactly you want the president of Poland to do?" he asked Bunch. "That's classified." "Cotton has the highest clearance," Stephanie noted, irritation in her voice. "How's that possible? He doesn't even work for the government. Getting that kind of clearance takes credentials."
"Like the kind that come from posting kiss-ass crap on the internet and working as an assistant financial advisor for a rich fat cat?"
Bunch's face went sour.
"I don't have to explain myself to you. I currently work for the President of the United States. Maybe this meeting wasn't such a good idea."
The guy stood.
"You're not eating?" Cotton asked.
"Or at least picking up the tab."
Bunch pinched back the sleeve of his jacket and studied his watch.
"I don't think so, on either count. Stephanie, Find help elsewhere.
No. Strong, clear, emphatic. The tone screaming non-negotiable.
Excuse me, Bunch said.
What part of that word don't you understand? She said. I've retained Cotton's services. We'll be using him.
Do you want me to call the White House?
She shrugged.
That's your decision.
But you're running out of time, and Cotton is the best. We caught a break that he happened to be here today.
I don't see it that way.
You don't see much of anything, Cotton said. Bunch stared at him.
You have an admirer. Her name is Sonia Draga. She works for the Agencia Viviadu, the AW.
He could see that Bunch had no idea what he was talking about. It's Poland's foreign intelligence agency, he said.
And she's here? Bunch asked.
She was. Gone now.
Cotton pointed out the window. It's where I went.
She left the table, Stephanie said, before you made it over there. But not before tossing me a wave. She definitely has style.
You know this woman? Bunch asked.
It's my business to know people like her. Cotton's right. She's an excellent operative. She came along after Solidarity and went to work for the new Polish Republic. Her presence here is a message.
Bunch sat back down at the table.
I'm listening.
Cotton nearly smiled.
Sure he was listening, since he had no friggin' idea what was happening.
President Tchaikovsky has to be aware of the auction, Stephanie said. He may have even been extended an invitation too. What better way to up the price than to have the proposed victim bidding? So he sent his number one operative to deal with it. Sonia being here in Bruges when the holy blood is taken? That's no coincidence.
Did she steal the relic? Bunch asked.
Cotton shook his head.
Hardly. Otherwise, she'd be long gone.
Incredible this idiot could not put two and two together, since this time it only came to four.
Obviously, Stephanie said, our problem just amplified.
Chapter 12. Tchaikovsky sat inside his private study. He had been back at the presidential palace for nearly 2 hours, secluded. His wife had gone to the opera for the evening. Thank goodness she loved the arts, devoting a lot of her time to their promotion. He had no interest in such things. Sadly, their marriage had failed. Both of them recognized that it was over, but both of them liked their positions. He as president, she as first lady. So they'd come to a private arrangement. An understanding. Separate private lives. Separate interests. Separate lovers. But always discreet. Never embarrassing the other or jeopardizing their positions. He knew she'd already found someone, and he was happy for her. He, too, had someone special. But it was politics, not love, that seemed to consume him on a daily basis. And a good thing, too. Poland seemed overrun by politics. There were two major parties, the PO and the PIS. But the variety of middling, minor, and other nonsensical groups seemed endless. About 40 at last count, scattered across a wide spectrum of beliefs. Anything and everything. Catholics, conservatives, liberals, communists, socialists, corporatists, nationalists, social democrats, feminists, right-to-lifers. You name it. There was a political party representing that interest. His favorite? One from the past. The Polska Partia Przyjaciół Piwa. The Polish Beer Lovers Party. Its original aim had been to promote beer drinking in English-style pubs instead of vodka, all designed to fight alcoholism. It emerged in 1990, right after the communist fall, and incredibly, voter disillusionment led 3% of the electorate to vote for its candidates, allowing it to win 16 seats in parliament. Its platform of quality beer served nationwide became a symbol of freedom of association and expression, intellectual tolerance, and a higher standard of living. Word of mouth also contributed to its popularity, with many openly saying that with the PPPP at the helm, it wouldn't be better. But for sure it would be funnier. But as was typical, The party soon split into factions and eventually dissolved to nothing. That seemed to be Poland's fate, too. Rise and fall. One incarnation after another. The country had always been surrounded by empires. Swedes to the north, Cossacks east, Prussians west, Turks in the south, with no natural borders east or west, allowing for a free flow of invaders. And they'd come for centuries. It didn't help that most of the terrain was flat, open plain, ideal for a battlefield, which made it easy for the heel of oppression to always be firmly planted on Poland's neck. Eventually, a defined state emerged, but it was wiped from the political map in 1795, when Russia, Prussia, and Austria divided up the country, the first European nation to ever meet such a fate. A provision of their secret agreement stressed the necessity of abolishing everything which might recall the existence of a Polish kingdom. Which was precisely what they did. The Prussians melted down the crown jewels. The Austrians turned palaces into barracks. The Russians stole everything they could. Then they collectively proclaimed that Poland had merely been an uncivilized corner of the world in need of redemption. A second chance at statehood came in the 20th century, but first the Germans stole it away, then the Soviets finished the task. Once they liberated the country from the Nazis, they never left. By 1948, the communists totally controlled Poland. Even worse, the Allies at Potsdam reconfigured the borders, ceding away long-held territory and adding new portions, shifting the entire nation 200 kilometers to the west, making it a different place from before the war. Its first president supported Stalin unconditionally and imposed harsh and repressive measures to cow the people. Workers supposedly played a vital role in running things, but in reality had no say whatsoever. The standard of living decreased by the year. Most of the national budget went to the military. Coal and other commodities were shipped free to the Soviet Union. The first seeds of rebellion were planted in 1956, but it took a quarter century for those to sprout, and another decade to bloom. Only recently had the communist yoke finally been broken and a republic once again established. But the radical shift from one-party rule to a liberal democracy and pluralism had encouraged new thought. No single party had ever achieved any measure of control. Instead, Poland was governed by ever-changing compromise. Hence, politics consumed his every thought. He often thought it akin to trying to hold 10 balloons underwater all at once. One was always slipping away, popping to the surface. And by the time it was retrieved, another managed to break loose. It was a nearly impossible task, but one that had to be tried if you wanted to govern the nation. His current coalition of 8 varied parties seemed fragile at best, a nervous collection of hawks, doves, and activists. Now the new American president had decided to force himself upon Poland with another cursed European interceptor site. He'd served in the government years back, as undersecretary in the foreign ministry, when the idea had first been proposed, then ultimately rejected by all, including the Americans. Now the dead had come back to life, and in more ways than one. He'd genuinely thought the past gone. It all should have died with the communists. The Institute of National Remembrance and its Commission for the Prosecution of Crimes Against the Polish Nation had spent years investigating both the Nazi and the communist times. He was there when Parliament issued its mandate for full disclosure, and for the past 20 years, the Commission had collected millions of pages of archival documents, interviewed thousands of witnesses, and convicted nearly 150 people of crimes against peace and humanity. All well and good. Since none of it had involved him. So far. He continued to chew on his thoughts, but hated the bitter aftertaste. He'd not tasted such disgust in a long time. A soft knock snapped his glum reverie. The door opened, and his private secretary said that the head of the BOR was ready to speak with him. Finally. Maybe some answers. Michał Zima entered, and they were left alone.
I have some bad news, Jima said. The son was found dead. He hanged himself.
He was shocked. How is that possible?
We had no indication that he was suicidal. After questioning, I had him placed in a holding cell. He used a bedsheet fastened to one of the bars.
He rubbed his tired eyes. Damn it.
He should have some pity for both the mother and son, but it was the son who had brought all their troubles onto them. I'm assuming the guilt over his mother's death was too much, Jima said. He was upset when he was told and asked for some time alone. Nothing indicated that he would hurt himself. I planned to release him shortly.
Why?
He's broken no law. We were pushing things, bringing him in for questioning. But I justified that based on the situation.
What situation?
Whatever it is the son sold. I can only assume it is a direct threat to the presidency.
Or this nation.
If that were true, then I would not be kept in the dark. I sense that this is more personal.
True.
But he still was not about to explain himself. The files from the house had been brought into the palace and lay stacked across the study's parquet floor. He'd given every page a cursory look and determined there was nothing that related to him, which meant the important stuff was already gone. Sold. To a man named Jonty Olivier. Jima knew nothing other than what the son had done.
Did the son tell you anything about what he sold?
Jima shook his head. I had not progressed that far in my questioning. I planned to do that once I returned from meeting with you. But by then, he was dead.
Which now seemed like a fortuitous happening.
But he did not like people dying in custody. It brought back memories from the 1970s and 1980s.
What a time.
A nationwide labor turmoil had led to the formation of the independent trade union Solidarity, which grew into a powerful independent political force. To stop its growth, in 1981 martial law was imposed, but 2 years of oppression failed to quell rising tensions. By 1989, the government was forced to hold the first partially free and democratic parliamentary elections since the end of World War II, ones they could not manipulate or control. A year later, the Soviet Union collapsed, and Lech Wałęsa, the head of Solidarity, won the presidency. Then, one by one, communist regimes imploded across Eastern Europe, and the Cold War ended. Throughout communist times, the Služba Bezpečenstva stayed at the forefront of the authoritarian state's efforts to hold on to power, spreading fear and terror. He knew the numbers. At the end, the SB employed 25,000 agents and had some 85,000 informants. It infiltrated every aspect of Polish life, trying to snuff out dissent. Places like Makatów prison flourished. Discontent had always simmered hotter in Poland than in any other Eastern Bloc nation, as there was no socialist tradition here. In fact, the whole concept of from each according to his ability to each according to his need, which Marx proclaimed, was contrary to the fiercely independent beliefs Poles held dear. All that was gone, though tonight a tiny piece of it had resurrected, and he felt awful. I want that man, Jonty Olivier, located, he said. We are working on that. I want a dossier on him too, everything you have, and fast.
Jima nodded.
Of course.
You can go.
Another privilege of office was the ability to end a conversation whenever he wanted. Jima left. The evening had turned into a circle of frustration, but he'd fought enough political battles to know that when you gambled, sometimes you lost. His best hope remained in Bruges, so he picked up the phone and dialed. A few moments later, Sonia Draga answered. He said, "Please tell me things are working out there."
Chapter 13. Cotton sat back in his chair and considered Stephanie's dilemma. What a tough position.
Professionals on one side, idiots on the other. Both dangerous. Nearly 20 years ago, Stephanie had plucked him from the Navy and provided him an opportunity to be something more than a lawyer. He'd accepted that offer and risen to the challenge, proving himself more than capable as an intelligence officer, which resulted in a major career shift to the Justice Department and the Magellan Billet. Stephanie created the unit, a special division within Justice to handle highly sensitive matters. 12 agents, whom she personally oversaw. He'd stayed for a dozen years, until a bullet tore through his shoulder in Mexico City. He'd managed to take down the shooters, but the resulting carnage had left 7 dead, 9 injured. One of them had been a young diplomat assigned to the Danish mission, Kai Torvaldsen. 10 weeks after the massacre, a man with a crooked spine appeared at his front door in Atlanta. They'd sat in the den, and he hadn't bothered to ask how Henrik Torvaldsen found him. "I came to meet the man who shot my son's killer," Torvaldsen said. "Why?" "To thank you."
"You could have called."
"I understand you were nearly killed." He shrugged. "And you're quitting your government job, resigning your commission, retiring from the military."
"You know an awful lot."
"Knowledge is the greatest of luxuries." He wasn't impressed. "Thanks for the pat on the back, and I'm truly sorry for your loss. But I have a hole in my shoulder that's throbbing and a lack of patience. So, since you've said your piece, could you leave?"
Torvaldsen never moved from the sofa. He simply stared at the den and the surrounding rooms visible through an archway. Every wall was sheathed in books. The house seemed nothing but a backdrop for the shelves.
"I love them too," his guest said. "I've collected books all my life."
"What do you want?"
"Have you considered your future?"
He motioned around the room. "Thought I'd open an old bookshop. Got plenty to sell."
"Excellent idea. I have one for sale, if you'd like it."
He decided to play along, but there was something about the older man's eyes that told him his visitor was not joking. Veined hands searched a suit coat pocket, and Torvaldsen laid a business card on the sofa.
"My private number. If you're interested, call me."
He'd made the call, then finalized his divorce, quit his job, sold his house, and moved from Georgia to Denmark, never regretting a day. Earlier, in the Basilica, memories of that day in Mexico City had come rushing back. People in danger, him there, able to act. Do something. And he had. But he'd made mistakes in Mexico City, ones he tried hard never to repeat, like underestimating the opposition. "Mr. Bunch," he said, "you have a highly qualified agent of a foreign government who went out of her way to let us know she's here. There's a reason she did that, a reason that obviously concerns Poland." The restaurant was becoming noisy, filling with diners. Bunch sat oblivious, sipping his expensive wine. Cotton did not like discussing such a sensitive subject in so public a place. "Should we not leave?" he asked, looking at Stephanie. She motioned, like, "Do you really think I'm in charge?"
"We can talk right here," Bunch declared.
He shrugged, indicating, "What the hell? Why not? More amateur hour." "Cotton," Stephanie said, "when we responded to the auction invitation, I'm told that the information sent back via email said the price of admission was us bringing a specific artifact. No artifact, no admission." Now he understood. "One of the Arma Christi." She nodded. "Ours is the Holy Lance, the Spear of St. Maurice in Krakow, Poland."
"Which might further explain Sonia Draga's appearance."
"Of the 7 relics, Stephanie said, 5 have already been taken. By who? We have no idea. But they'll be bringing their respective relic to the auction, so we'll learn all that then. There are 2 left, the Holy Lance, which is our ticket, and the nail in the cathedral at Bamberg, Germany. We have to have the lance in our possession by tomorrow at midnight, a little more than 27 hours from now. If not, then we can't attend."
"Just wait.
Then locate and raid the auction, he said. Bunch smirked. It's not that easy. No location was provided. That will come after we have the relic. The explanation came with an as-if-I-have-to-explain-something-so-obvious tone.
You're telling me you can't find the location? Cotton asked. You have the most extensive intelligence network in the world.
The thinking, Stephanie said, is that the others invited will have competing interests. Some want the information. Some want it destroyed. It may not be so easy to shut things down. I'm also assuming that this jaunty Olivier will take the necessary precautions against a preemptive strike. He surely knows that there could be trouble.
And you have no idea what you're buying.
Not true, Bunch said. A sample was provided with the invitation. Cotton was curious. If I hadn't come along, what were you planning on doing?
I had someone else in mind to work with us, she said.
That's what I was arranging in Brussels.
It's why I'm here too, Bunch added. I'll be attending the auction with the relic to bid for the information.
That was a bad idea on a multitude of levels.
Orders from the White House and the Attorney General, Stephanie said.
He got the message. No sense beating that dead horse. But he had to say to her, you do have a lot of problems here. Bunch seemed irritated.
I get it that you two think I have no business in this, but that's not your call. The president says I do, so can we create a workable plan?
Does that mean I'm now acceptable?
Sure, Malone, why not? What choice do I have?
Stephanie's right, time is short.
Who was this guy fooling?
That way, if I fail, you blame it all on her. She picked me.
Bunch grinned. Something like that.
Cotton, Stephanie said, we've already done the preliminary legwork. We know where the spear is being held and how it can be taken.
I saw the spear of St. Morris once years ago, he said. It's inside Vauvel Castle's Cathedral Museum.
Not at the moment, which is to our advantage. The message we received from Olivier indicated that the relic has to be stolen before any further information is provided. I assume the theft itself is some sort of proof. Obviously, we can't borrow the spear from the museum, or ask the Poles to cooperate with us. Why would they? The last person they would want to obtain damaging information on Tchaikovsky is Fox. With Sonia here in Belgium, that means Poland is now part of this equation. They also would not want that auction to happen. I'm sure Sonia has been charged with stopping it.
Unless Poland got an invite of their own, he added.
That's possible, she said. But my gut says that didn't happen.
Do you think Tchaikovsky knows the price of America's admission?
She shook her head.
Which is probably also why Sonia is here. The holy blood is gone. So she's focused now on the lance and the nail in Bamberg, waiting for us to make a move.
For all she knows, we took the holy blood, Bunch added.
Which was the first thing this guy had said that made sense.
He has a point.
Stephanie nodded. It's possible. But you'll need to figure that out.
Obviously, the nature of the blackmail was political, and damning enough to attract a lot of interest. But he learned a long time ago to know the stakes of the game before anteing up.
Do you plan to tell me the nature of this information on Tchaikovsky? You got a sample.
Bunch raised a hand to stifle the question.
I told you that's classified, and it's not necessary for you to know. We just need you to obtain the spear.
He now knew what to say, and stood from the table.
I'll pass.
Chapter 14. Jaunty stepped from the car. After dinner, he and Vic had driven north from the castle, crossing into Poland, heading toward Krakow. But before reaching the city, they'd veered east and found the town of Wieliczka. He'd always had a tough time with Polish. So many different sounds to familiar letters. Wieliczka was a perfect example, pronounced Wieliczka. The salt mines had always fascinated him. According to legend, in the 13th century, Duke Bolesław of Krakow wanted a bride,
So he arranged a marriage to Kinga, the daughter of the King of Hungary. Being a practical woman, Kinga asked her father for an unusual dowry, something to help build prosperity in her new homeland. So he gave her a salt mine. But it was located in Hungary, a long way from Poland. In a gesture of thanks, she cast her engagement ring into the mine's shaft. Years later, once in Poland, she visited Wieliczka, where salt had recently been discovered. While there, one of the workers presented her with a lump of salt that contained a shiny object. When it was broken open, she saw it to be her engagement ring, which had found its way there underground, all the way from Hungary. That fanciful tale explained two things. First, why St. Kinga was the patron of Polish salt miners, and second, why there'd been a salt mine at Wieliczka for the past 700 years. And what a place. 9 levels, the first one 60 meters down, the last more than 300. 250 kilometers of tunnels snaked a labyrinth through the earth, which led to over 2,000 chambers hollowed by 40 generations of miners. The real credit for its discovery goes to local farmers who found the salt deposits by accident, then started digging. Before that, salt either had come from brine or had been imported. But after, a less expensive and plentiful alternative became available. Salt. Gray gold. Produced when a base and an acid react to each other, more specifically when sodium joins with chlorine, producing sodium chloride, a staple food and the only rock humans can digest. And thank goodness. The body could not produce salt. It had to come externally. And it was vital. 250 grams were lost by an adult every day and had to be replaced. No sodium? No oxygen moved through the blood. No nerve impulses or muscles moved, including the heart. No digestion. Its perpetual value came from its constant loss and the need for continual replacement. It has always been one of the most sought-after commodities, unique because even dissolved into a liquid, it can be evaporated back out. In Poland, the obtaining and selling of salt had always been a royal right, making kings wealthy and keeping the locals employed. During the Middle Ages, 7,000 to 8,000 tons of salt were extracted per year from the earth below him, and that continued well into the 20th century. The time was approaching 8 p.m., and the mine was closing down. Nearly 2 million people visited a year, all on guided tours, the last official one leaving at 7:30, as a nearby wall sign explained. After hours, by special appointment, tours were available, which he assumed had been arranged through their contact. He followed Vic inside an attractive Art Nouveau building that accommodated the Regis shaft, sunk in the 14th century and the oldest of the ways down. Once the miners had descended by rope into the deep recesses, elevators handled the task today, the ones here used by the special tours. Two other sets were in differing locations, one for the horde of daily tourists and the other for miners who still worked below, keeping the passages safe and open. A few people were still around inside the building, removing olive-green coveralls and mining hats, talking with excitement, apparently just returned from a trip below. A man waited for them, also dressed in coveralls, only his were a beige color. A name stitched to the outside read, Conrad. Jaunty knew that several hundred guides led groups through the mine. Each one was trained and certified. Most worked only part-time. Conrad was a hybrid, being one of the full-time miners still employed at the site, but assigned to public relations duties for special tours. Thankfully, Conrad was also deeply in debt thanks to 2 failed marriages and some reckless spending. A few thousand euros had bought his unquestioned loyalty. It bothered Jaunty that an outsider was so close to things. But this situation was unusual, to say the least. Timing was everything in his business. Important information today could be worthless tomorrow. The trick was to make a deal while things were hot. That's why he'd been overly generous with this corruptible soul.
As a precaution, Vic had kept a close eye on Conrad, and nothing unusual had piqued their interest. Of course, the spy's appearance and the mention of Reinhardt had sparked a new wave of paranoia.
"I didn't realize you'd be coming," Conrad said to him.
"Is it a problem?" Jaunty asked.
"I had only planned for one for this special tour, but I can make the adjustment. Give me a minute."
Conrad walked off. Jaunty stepped over to a large sign that mapped out the tunnels below and explained what he was about to experience. "Covered in working clothes and armed with mining equipment, visitors to the Vialichka mine stop feeling like tourists as soon as they descend into the darkness by the oldest existing mine shaft, the Regis. The trail, located far off the busy tourist route, allows visitors to discover the inner workings of the mine. On their own, they measure the concentration of methane, grind and transport salt, set the path, and explore unknown chambers. They also experience the daily routine of underground life and the secrets of mining traditions and rituals, and experience firsthand the real taste of miners' work." It all sounded so adventurous. "Visitors receive a protective coverall, a lamp, and helmet. Please bring warm clothing. Temperature underground ranges between 14 degrees and 16 degrees Celsius. Wear comfortable, waterproof footwear." Which he'd done. He'd come a long way from his beginnings. He started out as a black market dealer, mainly fencing stolen supplies acquired from U.S. military bases scattered across Europe. Anything and everything. The supply of buyers had seemed unending. He made a lot of money and managed to stay out of jail. Then he progressed into people, becoming a recruiter. If someone needed an experienced burglar, a qualified arms expert, or a high-tech hacker, he found the right person for the right price. Incredible that no one had started such a service before. Everybody thought criminals either all knew one another or formed their alliances on a whim. Not so. An inability to advertise, the scrutiny of law enforcement, and an overall lack of honesty made it tough to find good help. After all, you couldn't ask for references. He'd solved that problem and made a lot more money in the process. He'd had only one rule. He never worked for murderers, terrorists, or kidnappers. For nearly a decade, he was the underworld's number one employment agency. Then a third shift into information. Another service few had exploited. Unfortunately, no university offered any degree in his line of work. No trade unions sponsored apprenticeships. No traditions existed upon which to draw. You simply learned as you went. And he had, making mistakes here and there, but never repeating them. His reputation had grown such that he was considered one of half a dozen people in the world who could supply good, reliable information. Now he was on the verge of the biggest deal of all, provided he could keep everything under control for another 2 days. Every life had a turning point. This was his. Conrad returned.
"All is done. I laid out mining kits for you both in the locker room. Slip on the coveralls, then meet me with your helmets and lights over there at the elevator."
Chapter 15. Cotton left the restaurant. Stephanie had offered no argument to get him to change his mind, her eyes signaling that she understood. $150,000 was nowhere near enough compensation to deal with a guy like Tom Bunch. He actually felt for her. But Stephanie was a big girl. She could handle things. Still, whoever else she had in mind to deem with Bunch, God help them. He wondered why she stayed on the job. Just retire. Find something else to do. She could make a fortune in the private sector. But he knew the answer. The Magellan billet was her life. She was a loyal soldier, the kind you wanted on your side, and normally he'd do anything for her. But his personal bullshit tolerance level had long ago dropped to zero, and he was simply not the guy to babysit Tom Bunch. The fading light of a northern dusk had taken hold,
the June evening air dry and pleasant. The streets were choked with people, vendor carts, and bicycles that sped along at a fast clip. He'd had an interesting afternoon, to say the least. He missed the job, for sure, but he didn't miss dealing with assholes like Bunch, and he'd had his share of them. He hated leaving Stephanie in the lurch, and knew that her not insisting he stay meant he owed her one. But that was okay. He'd owed her before. He kept walking, retracing the route he and Stephanie had taken earlier, past the fish market, the old town hall, and the Basilica of the Holy Blood. All was quiet at the church, the front doors closed for the day, the square out front still dotted with camera-toting tourists. No sign of any police or any other indication something unusual had happened there earlier. He followed another busy street and passed retail stores on both sides, most still trying to lure in a few last customers. The path drained into the central market, his hotel on the far side of the open expanse. He should call Cassiopeia. They spoke at least once a day. He missed her. Strange to have those feelings about someone else, but he'd come to welcome them. Thankfully, each provided the other a wide berth. No clinginess. Each cherished their own space, but they also cherished each other. He'd even given the M-word a little thought. Marriage would be a huge step. But they both always found a reason to avoid the subject. Their relationship a mixture of need, apprehension, and shyness. He'd been divorced a while, and his ex-wife lived back in Georgia with their son, Gary. All was good there. Finally. But it had taken a struggle, one he had no desire to repeat. It was time to get his mind back on why he'd come to Bruges. He had a budget for the purchase of the three books, which should be more than enough. Their resale would entail at least a 25% markup, not a bad return on a few days' work. He should be able to make the buys and be back in Copenhagen by tomorrow afternoon. He'd taken the train so his return could be flexible, but he definitely needed to be home by Friday. Cassiopeia was due in Denmark that evening for a few days, which he was looking forward to. A crowd had gathered around the statues of Jan Bredel and Peter de Koninck, a butcher and weaver, two Flemish revolutionaries who led a 14th-century uprising against the French. He doubted any of the gawkers knew their historical significance. Bars and restaurants dominated the square's perimeter, everything alive with hustle and bustle. He rounded the statues and was about to turn for the side street that led to his hotel when he caught sight of a woman, her long legs, lean figure, and blonde hair distinctive. She wore jeans with boots and a silk blouse, and was moving away from a row of flagpoles toward another of the streets radiating from the square. Sonia Draga. She'd intentionally revealed herself back at the restaurant. Surely, seeing him with Bunch and Stephanie had raised suspicions. Why wouldn't it? But there'd been no opportunity for him to explain. Maybe now was the chance. He kept watching as she dissolved into the crowd. Then something else caught his attention. Two familiar faces. Two-thirds of the three amigos. Following Sonia. Leave it alone. Walk away. Yeah, right. He headed in her direction. At the junction of the side street and the market square, he caught sight of Sonia 50 yards ahead, the two amigos in pursuit. Buildings lined both sides, and there were enough people moving back and forth for no one to be noticed. But Sonia had to know she had company, as these guys weren't making any secret about their presence. She turned and disappeared into one of the buildings. The two amigos followed. Nothing about this seemed right. But he kept going until he came to a pedimented arch that led through one of the gabled houses, forming an alley about 50 feet long. No one was in sight. He walked through the covered passage into a courtyard flanked by more old houses. Wrought iron lanterns suspended from the stone facades cast a dim glow. Another covered passage led out on the opposite side. Three doors dotted the exterior walls to his left and right, all closed. Where'd everybody go? He heard a click and turned to see the two amigos standing behind him, one of them armed with a gun. That way, the guy said, motioning with the weapon at one of the closed doors. No choice. He turned.
The door opened, and Sonia emerged. She walked by him and gently stroked his cheek with her hand.
Sorry, Cotton. It had to be done.
Chapter 16. Tchaikovsky realized that he could not sit back and allow things to happen. His whole life was at stake, perhaps even the entire country's future. Someone named Jonty Olivier was out to destroy him. He'd long expected threats from the various political parties, hostile ministers in parliament, opposition leaders, even the media, which was not always kind. But never had he thought a foreigner would become so dangerous. It had been a long time since he'd thought of that day at Makatuf prison. Many times he'd wondered what had happened to the math professor tied to the stool. The last he saw, the man had been forced to crawl on hands and knees from the interrogation room back to his cell. How degrading. He'd been so young then, so afraid. Major Deletsky of the SB had brought him there to make a point. Do as he was told, or face the same consequences. Countless people had been arrested and tortured. In addition to beatings and burnings, the most popular methods of interrogation had been to rip off fingernails, apply temple screws, clamp on tight handcuffs that caused the skin to burst and blood to flow, force prisoners to run up and down stairs, deprive them of sleep, make them stand at attention for hours, reduce their rations, pour buckets of cold water into cells, leave them in solitary confinement. Anything and everything imaginable to break a person down. All of it had been applied in a harsh, premeditated manner, without remorse or discrimination. Those who fainted were revived with an adrenaline shot. Before some of the sessions, which could last for hours, many received booster injections to keep them alert. Torturers strictly followed the wishes of interrogating officers like Deletsky. A damn disgrace. And for what? That brave man on the floor that day had been right. What the foreign force has taken from us, we shall with saber retrieve. And that was precisely what had happened. The communists were finally driven away, and Poland returned to its people. But at what cost? During martial law, many had stayed in prison for years, until a general amnesty finally forgave everyone. Till today. He never knew what happened to Deletsky, but apparently the major had kept up with him, secreting documents that should have long ago been destroyed. One day, you might be a big somebody. What a bastard. Makatuf prison still existed, now used by the government as a short-term holding facility. No one, though, had been abused there in a long time. A huge plaque now adorned one of the outer walls commemorating the victims. What happened inside those concrete cells, in unimaginable conditions, had been the subject of books and memoirs. Nobody really knew how many died there, and few paid for those atrocities. Unfortunately, justice back then seemed more like a leaf in the spring air, at the mercy of the twists from an unpredictable wind. Now, here he was, decades later, still dealing with it. How had things come to this? He was 56 years old, a respected citizen of Poland, one who'd managed to attain the highest elected office in the land. His mother had wanted him to become a priest, because back then the clearest path to an education came from the church. All children were taught in school to be subservient to the state and obedient workers to the collective. No mention of individuality ever came. People were helpless in directing their own lives. But he managed to obtain a university degree, eventually heading up, during the time of martial law, a branch of the Independent Students' Union, the junior arm of Solidarity. That position had been what caught Deletsky's attention, along with his operation of an underground publishing house. He'd been quite the radical, but everyone was back then. The country was changing, the world was changing, and he'd wanted to be part of that change. He went on to serve in all aspects of government. First elected to parliament when he was 30, he served 4 terms before moving to the executive branch.
He'd been an Undersecretary of State, the Vice Minister of National Defense, the General Secretary of two political parties, then back to Parliament where he rose to Vice Speaker. He came from a solid, respected family with not a hint of scandal or shame. His grandfather fought with valor in the Polish-Soviet War, his father in World War II. The Catholic Church meant everything to him. He remembered vividly the night in May 1981 when word came that John Paul II had been shot. Their beloved favorite son lay fighting for his life. Tchaikovsky had been on his way to a solidarity meeting. Instead, he'd wandered into a church where hundreds of people knelt in prayer and a priest said Mass. Above the altar hung a dark painting of the crucifixion. He recalled thinking that once again, Poles faced a calamity. The life of their pope was in peril, their economy in shambles. Russian tanks were massing at the border. The country seemed on the rack. Yet before him was the strangely calming image of a man splayed by crucifixion. Not only a symbol of the nation's turmoil, but a promise of redemption, too. He recalled what someone once wrote, "Poland is the Jesus Christ of nations." How true. And how ironic that the passions of Christ could now be part of his own undoing. He felt like he was about to be crucified, too. Everyone had been so young back then. The head of the largest Solidarity branch in Warsaw was a mere 25. The leader of the Gdansk Shipyard Union, barely 21. Most of the high officers in Solidarity were all in their late 20s and early 30s. Lech Wałęsa, at the helm, had been the old man at 37. It had been young men and women who'd fought the battle against communism. Youth definitely came with fire and fury, but it also came with bad judgment and inexperience. No one had known where it all was going or how it would end. Solidarity seemed many times as lost as the nation. The government-controlled media blamed the union for everything, including food shortages. Hearing it so often, people began to believe the lies. A slogan resonated across the nation. The government takes care of laws, the party takes care of politics, and Solidarity takes care of the people. But many times he'd wondered if that was true. Few had been able to articulate what the nation wanted, but everyone knew what they didn't want. A distant, arbitrary, central authority full of repression. Decades of mismanagement and corruption finally caught up with the communists. The red bourgeoisie benefited,